Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, and today we're descending into the dungeon of humanity once again for an especially mysterious and vicious massacre that seems to perpetually haunt the collective psyche of America. The Villisca Axe Murders, which occurred in southeastern Iowa all the way back in June 1912. The crime occurred inside the home of Josiah and Sarah Moore, who both lost their lives, in addition to their four children and two of the neighbor's kids, for a total of eight people bludgeoned to death by an axe in a single event with no credible witnesses and no damning evidence. According to police, the crime occurred sometime between 10 p.m. on June 9th and 5 a.m. on June 10th, with the most likely time for the assault being approximately midnight. What we know for sure is that at least one man entered the Moore home during this time and managed to murder every person sleeping inside without waking anyone who was subsequently afforded enough time to call for help, run, or even make enough noise to be noticed by anybody nearby. Furthermore, the murder weapon in question is a single axe owned by none other than Josiah Moore. So, we're going to learn a little bit more about who these people were and who might want to kill them, in addition to entertaining the possibility of a stranger committing a crime of opportunity. Of course, we'll delve into the psychology of the murders as well, and how the resulting societal implications mirror the crime perfectly. Yes, I mean mirror in a literal sense. You see, the mirrors in the house were covered with bedsheets after the murders, and so were the victims' faces. So we're going to take a trip down the rabbit hole of your secrets and dive into a virtual basket of soiled clothing to unearth the beginnings of that fascinating little emotional phenomenon we know very simply on planet Earth as dirty laundry. I believe the answer to the whodunit aspect of this crime is in the psychology afforded by the evidence, and not something that can be extracted from the event in a tangible manner. The same goes for motive. Forensic science was terribly primitive at the time, and fingerprinting technology was in its infancy. So, we're going to jump into all of these subjects and more, but first a few mentions here. If you haven't had a chance to download my recent bonus episode near the top of my feed, please take a moment to do so. Also, please follow Cold Case Murder Mysteries on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and your 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts are also greatly appreciated and help others to find my show. Beyond that, you can also find me on Patreon if you feel so inclined to donate. There's also a one-time PayPal donation link on my website for those interested. Finally, in the coming days after the release of this episode, Cold Case Murder Mysteries will be opening a merch store on Threadless, where you can find everything from t-shirts to coffee mugs to wall art. There are a ton of products available, but only a few designs so far. I'm working on more at the moment, and they'll be available soon. Thanks so much for your support. Okay, enough of the business. Let's do this. Villisca was a town of about 2,500 residents at the time, located in the rural Midwest, specifically Montgomery County in southeastern Iowa. If you haven't seen images of the home, I recommend either Googling it or just considering it a white farmhouse type of structure. It's apparent there are neighbors nearby, but not in great number, or even within a proximity that would undoubtedly draw their attention if a strange man was walking around at night. So on the morning of June 9th, Josiah Moore places a call to the parents of sisters Lena and Ina Stillinger, ages 12 and 8 respectively, who are friends of the Moore's daughter Catherine, age 9. He's seeking permission for the girls to stay at the Moore house overnight when the services at the local Presbyterian church conclude. They're attending the Children's Day program, which begins at 8 p.m. Now, Josiah is not actually able to reach the Stillinger parents when he calls, but he manages to pass the message through Blanche Stillinger, an older sibling. So there's really no confirmation as to whether the Stillingers approved or disapproved, but I think it's probably irrelevant to the events to follow anyhow. Sarah Moore was essentially the person conducting the exercises that evening, and Josiah supposedly remained in the congregation. The activities ended at approximately 9:30 p.m., at which point the Moores walked home with the Stillinger sisters in tow. The remaining Moore siblings not yet mentioned are brothers Herman, 11, Boyd, 7, and Paul, 5. So, the family and two guests arrive back at the Moore home somewhere between 9:45 to 10 p.m., and they're never seen alive again. Okay, this is 1912 in the Midwest, and I'm not quite sure if school has let out for the year yet, or even what type of schooling these kids received. But it stands to reason that if the oldest kid is 11, they wouldn't be awake much later than that. And the Moors were known for being outside and doing chores early in the morning, so we can assume they went to bed early and expected the same of their children. So as we take the first foray into the psychology of the crime here, it's interesting to note that many people believe the massacre was committed by a transient with murderous tendencies brought on by some type of untreated mental illness. Perhaps some type of a fringe character we would now most likely identify as a sociopath. And of course, we get that. So we'll talk about those individual suspects. But for now, let me focus on this notion as being disingenuous in nature. Here's why. A transient, or even a thief, who had knowledge that you were away from the home would logically enter and leave during the time you were gone. This event is simply not random, or even a crime of opportunity, aside from the opportunity arising through knowledge of the victim's movements prior to the event. So the motive is clearly murder, and it's also a premeditated murder. Yet, the way we establish this is through the manner and extent of calculation apparent. Everyone in the home was killed without waking up and moving prior to being struck, with the exception of one of the Stillinger sisters, who may or may not have been moved. So it's possible nobody heard a sound whatsoever. Here's a clue for us, one that should also be obvious. If you're trying not to make a sound, even when some of the victims are small children who could do no more than run away, it most likely means that it's very important everybody in the house dies. Now we go on to learn this is true. And how? The Stillinger sisters are killed last, and everything about how they're found remains confusing, from an apparent sexual assault, to posing of the bodies, to a big slab of bacon found nearby. And if there's one thing I always preach about analyzing a crime scene, it's this. Look for the misdirection. Look for the unnatural. Crimes of passion, as disgusting as it sounds, are like art, in the sense that they tell a very compelling and frightening story about the truth of human motivation. But when it's a lie, when the evidence points in many directions, you can see it. And I believe that's what we have here. Now, as the axe was found in that room, we assume they were killed last, but we don't know for certain that they were. But in exchange for conceding that truth, we get something much more important in return. We believe that in the first place, because the axe was discovered in that bedroom, right? So even if the killer or killers didn't murder the Stillinger sisters last, the axe was placed in that room at the conclusion of the murders, which means that they either went in there last to kill the girls, or they went in there to do something else. Regardless of circumstance, it ends in there. So if we conclude that the Stillinger sisters were the least important victims, in terms of the motive for the crime, and were ultimately distractions, then they fall at the far end of the spectrum of the true target. We need to look no further than who was killed first. Now let's evaluate how we can determine that answer. The Stillinger sisters were in the downstairs bedroom, yet all of the other bedrooms were located upstairs. The evidence seems to suggest that the killer bypassed the sisters in favor of going upstairs first and killing the Moores. Of course, Josiah Moore, as a grown man, is likely the greatest threat to the attacker in terms of physical strength. In addition to that, he's the only person in the house who would have ties to business interests that might upset other people in the community. Aside from Sarah Moore, the eldest person in the home is 11. We're not aware of Sarah being involved in any type of affair or other risky pursuit that would draw this type of explosive anger. There are just simply too many people involved in this crime for me to believe that the intention was anything other than killing every member of the Moore family and anybody who might expose the killer in the process. This is a large number of murders for the victims to have been killed one by one. Ultimately, while considering this, I feel like the entire Moore family was the target of a premeditated act, essentially conducted by what we would commonly refer to as a hitman, with Josiah being the focal point of the attack and the assailant not being the person who desires him dead, but an associate of that person hired to carry out the violence. The Stillinger sisters getting murdered was nothing more than a result of collateral damage. They got in the way of the plan. And we're going to examine a very strong suspect who fits that mold as well. But we establish Josiah as the main target in two ways. One is that he's the only of the eight victims to be murdered with the blade of the axe. The others were all bludgeoned with the blunt end. It was intended to be decisive and instantly fatal. Yet this is where we find some interesting revelations, in the aftermath of this consideration. More specifically, the fact that he was asleep in bed with his wife Sarah. So try to picture this for a moment. The killer enters the house and ascends the stairs to the master bedroom specifically for the purpose of eliminating the man who is not only the greatest threat to their well-being during the attack, but the most likely person to be attached to reasons for the murders to occur in the first place. As I've espoused one too many times on the show, murders are about resources. Follow that trail, and there's your answer. Easier said than done, of course. Again, let's try to envision the first leg of the murders occurring. Josiah and Sarah are asleep in bed, and the murderer creeps up the stairs around midnight, armed with Josiah's axe that he presumably took from the shed outside. The common approach in modern days to unsolved axe murders of this period is to link them simply by the presence of an axe, but the reality is that this tool was used extensively and frequently by untold numbers of people and for normal daily activities, so it was as prevalent as a knife block might be to your kitchen today. Anyhow, we're in the bedroom observing this horrific act about to take place. The killer enters. He draws the axe back and over his head, at which point he may or may not have caused the gouges later found in the ceiling that match the weapon. That sound alone could have alerted a sleeping person, but that's purely speculation. What really interests me, however, is what happens next. Josiah is struck in the head with a vicious blow from the axe blade while sleeping. We know he was positioned on the bed in a normal fashion, with his wife next to him lying in the same manner. Presumably, they were both using a pillow, but if not, the point I'm about to make is even more legitimate. A devastating strike to a human head would likely cause the axe blade to become temporarily stuck in Josiah's head. Axe blades are specifically designed in the form of a wedge, the reason being that they separate dense material by way of force. The result of an axe strike is often not a clean separation, and the blade becomes stuck. Anyone who has chopped wood has endlessly wiggled the blade from the target after imperfect swings. Sometimes the swing actually is perfect, and the material doesn't sever due to its density or the circumstances. Either way, the fact of the matter is that the blade becoming stuck is inefficient because it allows for delay until the next strike. That's okay when you're out back chopping wood for the fireplace, but when you're trying to murder a family in silence, the blunt end is the way to go. Unless you must ensure immediate death. Your most decisive strike would come from the blade. So, ladies, imagine your 39-year-old Sarah Moore asleep in bed next to your husband, or whomever shares your bed, and suddenly he's struck in the head full force by an axe. Of course, the sound of the strike itself would probably be limited to a significant thud, something that might not wake another person, depending on how deeply he or she slept. That's fair. But the resulting impact upon the mattress, even though not direct, would be thunderous, especially if your head was located next to the first victim's. I can't bring myself to believe that a single killer could bring down a massive fatal blow upon Josiah's head without rattling the bed to an extent that Sarah was startled. Obviously, the man is aware of this possibility as he proceeds and knows he needs to act quickly, but it doesn't add up. Here's why. When the blade strikes, the killer then has to remove it. Even if he gets lucky enough to pull it out with one attempt to retract the blade, at least several seconds will transpire between the initial impact on the bed and his ability to strike a second target. The problem is that our brains, as I've discussed many times here, thirst for context. The brain must have very specific context in every situation, even if the circumstances dictate that any or all of the five senses aren't present. In their absence, the brain reassesses the situation with the understanding that the aforementioned sensory ability is currently unavailable. But no matter the level of confusion, the first thing the brain will do, and especially in situations that include sudden and unexpected danger, is seek context. So, if the bed shakes hard from the axe blow, it's going to wake Sarah. Her brain will immediately recognize this as potential danger, because it falls outside the routine it's experienced when she goes to bed every night. Her first instinct will be to assess the danger. That's how the fight-or-flight instinct initiates. What happens first is the eyes will attempt to make contact with a visual of the potential danger. The body follows suit in turning toward it as well, because a stance that faces your enemy is the best way to protect yourself from a direct attack. It allows use of the arms and legs to create distance between your vital organs and your opponent's weapon, whether it's his hands, a knife, or even an axe. You don't need to do more than watch a boxing match or an MMA fight to understand this concept. The term, face your fears, also has a literal interpretation. It's the reason we use it so often in an emotional context. So, Sarah's immediate instinct upon the impact of the first strike would be to turn to the danger to make a fight-or-flight assessment. Now, being asleep could certainly inhibit the timing of this action. That only makes sense. But people regularly move when startled awake. Yet Sarah doesn't do that here. We're expected to believe that this axe slammed Josiah's head and then left the killer enough time to remove the blade from his skull, raise the weapon again, taking the time to flip sides to the blunt end, and bring it down on Sarah's head before she becomes startled in turns. That's unlikely. On the verge of being impossible. And again, that situation could have been reversed. Sarah could have been struck first. Which brings me back to an earlier point. This crime is so audacious, and yet there was seemingly so little to gain at the scene. At the same time, it's very calculated, and not the work of someone who is perhaps suffering a schizophrenic episode. These are also not thrill kills. They're brutal, but not messy or gratuitous. The actions are swift and decisive, with immediate death being the intent, not suffering. This is very emotionless, and not the work of a sadistic killer thirsting for blood. One of the Stillinger sisters was missing her underwear, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence of an extensive sexual assault that would warrant murdering seven other people to conceal. In addition to that, if the motive had been sexual assault, specifically of the Stillinger sisters, the killer likely would have opted for perpetrating the crime at their home rather than the Moores. So the conclusion I personally draw from the evidence regarding what happened in the master bedroom is that there was likely more than one attacker present. Josiah and Sarah were most likely struck by two people at the same time, each holding a similar axe. Forensic technology had not advanced to a point where a specific weapon could be definitively noted for its unique physical qualities. A similar axe could have easily led authorities to believe the single axe found at the crime scene was the lone weapon. And there's an importance to making the crime appear as though it was the result of a single perpetrator. It's intentional. Here's why. If the deaths appear to be the work of one man, then the perception will be that it was a devious plot he concocted alone and in the ignorance of others, like a serial killer or mass murderer. But if it's apparent two men or more are involved, that's when the red flags go up, the warning bells go off, because that's a conspiracy. Two or more people is not a loss of control. It's not mental illness, at least not exclusively. If it seems two or more people were involved, the police will dig deeper for motive because they're fully aware the act was agreed upon by two people in search of specific resources. And if they can't make any sense of a strong motive that exists in a tangible manner directly at the scene, including sex, money, or other valuable items, then the motive must be tied to interests that render resources. And the whole basis for crime to begin with is to reroute resources. If you find the man or men who had most to gain by the faucet being turned off on Josiah Moore's resources, you've probably found the guilty party. You can always count on one of two things being the case with a crime scene. Either the intended transfer of resources from the victim to the criminal takes place at the scene, or it's entirely, and not to mention intentionally, absent from the crime scene so as to conceal it. The foremost reason for doing so is that the nature of the crime reveals who's most likely to benefit with the deceased gone. So if we examine how the murders are initiated, the notion of a single perpetrator reveals that the entire plan could come down like a house of cards in the wind if anybody wakes up, given that the crushing blow to Josiah's skull would have violently shaken the mattress. Yet Sarah doesn't scream in the seconds it would have taken for the man to remove the blade and bring it down upon her. She doesn't even move. According to the investigation, she didn't wake up during the attack. So I ask you, knowing that, are you more inclined to believe Sarah was struck after Josiah and simply remained asleep during the initial moments of the attack? Or does it seem more reasonable to say that she never made a move or a sound because she didn't have a chance to react to what happened to her husband, in the same way that he didn't have a chance to react? My money is on the latter, because if she happens to wake up, which is more than probable, bordering on inevitable, based upon the circumstances, and notices there's a killer standing over her dead husband, one who's about to kill her too, she's probably going to scream. She might even try to run. In fact, these things are even more likely to happen because she's also instantly going to think about the children, not only her own innocent offspring, but the neighbor's kids sleeping downstairs. Yet we get none of that. She gets butchered while sleeping. And why is it so probable the events happened this way? Let's take a look at how it might have transpired otherwise, with only a single killer. If the initial strike upon Josiah's head is delivered with deadly force, it's going to wake Sarah. We know Sarah has at least a few seconds to realize they're being attacked before the axe comes down on her head. If the terror of this aspect of the event isn't enough to make her verbally respond, in the form of a scream or a plea for the assailant to stop, then her next thought is going to be about the safety of the children. If she doesn't have time to yell for them to get out, she's going to scream or yell to alert them. Yet, she never moves. So we know she doesn't make a sound. The most likely reason for this result is that she was never afforded the opportunity. The bottom line is that Sarah seems to have been killed in the same manner as her husband, a total sneak attack with no warning. But the reality of how the event would have to transpire with only one assailant doesn't support this theory. But let's proceed in our examination of what might happen if she woke up to the bed getting rocked and saw blood spilling from her husband's head as the killer removed the blade and raised it to bring it down upon her. She screams at this point. She doesn't have time to do anything else, except perhaps make a defensive move like turning toward the killer and putting up a forearm, however futile it might be. People regularly try to stop bullets with their hands and arms, so certainly a possibility. Her screams are heard by at least one of her three sons sleeping on the same floor. He gets up to check it out and sees the killer. He screams. His brothers wake up. The girls downstairs hear it. They see the boys trying to run downstairs being chased by a man with an axe. They run out screaming toward their home. This thing is truly a house of cards as it's presented to us, and I'm not inclined to believe it happened that way. Now, this is pure speculation, but I believe there were at least two assailants, perhaps more, but that's the most likely number for me. I'm also inclined to believe they were probably in possession of a backup plan, primarily a firearm, with the implied condition that it wouldn't be used unless necessary, for obvious reasons. Utilizing the homeowner's axe goes a long way in creating the perception of a lone vagrant entering the home. But it's not a robbery. The house isn't ransacked. The crime is exceptionally clean and eerily quiet, with no one having seen or heard a thing. Now, getting back to Josiah and Sarah's bedroom, the police are ultimately going to find one of Sarah's shoes lying on the floor on its side, next to the bed on Josiah's side. They discover blood inside the shoe, yet also underneath it. The coroner, Dr. Lindquist, speculated that the killer delivered the initial attack on the couple, at which point he left the room and blood spilled off the bed into the shoe. After committing the other murders upstairs, the killer returned and delivered a few more blows to Josiah for good measure. When all was said and done, Josiah's eyes were missing from his face from the sheer force of the blows. But anyhow, the doctor speculates that the shoe was knocked over when the killer returned for the second attack. So clearly this second bludgeoning on Josiah is an indication of the assailant's insecurity that perhaps he might not have finished the job. Had rage been the motivating factor, he would have delivered a number of blows during the initial attack. The question he seems to be posing to himself within these insecurities is this: have I done enough? Only the head is struck. The body isn't chopped to pieces. He's simply trying to satisfy the requirement of being absolutely sure the victim is dead. Of course, these insecurities suggest only one thing. There will be consequences if Josiah doesn't die. Now, if you've just bludgeoned a man beyond recognition with an axe blade to the face, he's never going to be able to tell anyone who did it, even if he survives somehow. The brain damage inflicted from that type of blow would be irreparable, and clearly Josiah wasn't ever going to be able to make a visual identification of the perpetrator. So there has to be another element to Josiah's survival that concerns the man enough to make him come back and ensure death. So let's ask ourselves this. If Josiah survives an attack, even to remain incapacitated, will he retain his business interest? Yes. If Josiah is killed, will his wife, and subsequently his four children, have rights to continue engaging his business interests as their right to make a living, even in the eyes of the law? Yes. But if all of these people are dead, then those interests no longer belong to any of them. Ever. Those opportunities will be swallowed by other interested parties who move in to fill the gap in their absence. We just don't have the exchange of resources within the house. The motive is not there. So it must be outside the home. Now, we're going to take a look a little further into this as I get into the suspects, but let's also move on here to talk about the discovery of the crime scene the next morning. Early the next day, neighbor Mary Peckham rises to do her chores and notices that the Moores haven't yet done the same, which is unusual for them. By 7 a.m., this becomes such a concern for her that she decides to go knock on their front door. She gets no answer, and then notices all the curtains are still drawn on the windows, with the exception of two that are covered with the Moore's clothing. At this point, she calls Josiah's brother Ross, who promptly arrives to check on the family. Of course, all the doors are locked on the home. Ross has a key, but first tries looking into the downstairs bedroom window where the Stillinger girls are soon found, yet finds himself unable to see anything because the curtains are drawn. As he gets no response, Ross enters the home using his key, and the rest is history. But what is presented to us in the aftermath as an incredibly mysterious circumstance, an act of pure evil brought on by the mental instability of a lone psychopath, is actually just the result of a very common practice. People changing their minds at the last minute, in favor of something they deem a better plan. So, Ross finds the Stillinger girls dead in the bedroom off the living room, or the parlor as it might have been called back then. There's blood all over the bed, of course, and it appears that 8-year-old Ina was killed in her sleep, while 12-year-old Lena moved after being struck with the blunt end of the axe, sliding about halfway down the bed and turning toward its edge a bit. This could have been a reactionary move upon receiving the blow, or it could have happened just before the axe struck. Now, this does seem to make sense considering that Lena is the older sister and would likely have a larger head, allowing her to better absorb the same type of strike that killed her 8-year-old sister. Now, Ross goes no farther than this, but what he finds is that the kids' faces are covered with the bedclothes, and there's a kerosene lamp at the foot of the bed with the chimney off. Nearby on the floor is a large slab of bacon that weighs about 2 pounds, and it's wrapped in something that looks like a dish towel. Another slab of bacon the same size is later found in the icebox. Shortly thereafter, City Marshal Hank Horton arrives and discovers the 6 bodies of the Moore family in their beds upstairs. Just as is the case with the scene downstairs, a kerosene lamp is also found at the foot of the bed in Josiah and Sarah's room. The chimney is off, and it's noted that the wick is turned back. And this is where it gets really interesting. All of the mirrors in the home are covered by sheets and or clothing, in the same way the windows are covered, and in the same way the people's faces are covered. And I know everybody's probably thinking that I'm going to offer some very strange, obscure psychological reasons for this, but there aren't any. As I stated previously, these people change their minds, and what we end up with is a very confusing yet effective result that combines the abandoned approach and the one they actually utilized in the end. The key here is this evidence can't be viewed in its totality as a single entity. It's the threshold of 2 worlds with similar desires and different tactical measures. So here's what I propose. Let's take a look at everything in the house that's covered and ask ourselves why, independent of its correlation to everything else being covered. Now, if you had committed 8 brutal murders inside a home, it only makes sense you'd want to conceal that reality visually. You know that when Mary Peckham senses something wrong in the morning, she's going to check it out, but ultimately the police will enter and realize what's truly happened. So for criminals, it always makes sense to delay the discovery of the crime in question because it allows more time to escape the scene and return to your normal activities without arousing suspicion. Physical evidence also becomes less reliable with the passage of time. So drawing the curtains is a natural thing to do, as is covering them with clothes. But this happened last, in my opinion, and I'm going to explain why. Some say that the mirrors and victims' faces were covered because the killer didn't want them looking at him, and didn't want to see himself because he committed those atrocious acts. The same thing goes for the uneaten plate of food in the kitchen. Many say he was disgusted and shocked by his actions, unable to eat. But let's examine these things. The killer or killers obviously commit the murders inside the home by the light of the moon. They clearly didn't go in there and light the place up. So once the deaths occur, it's at that point they decide to cover the victims' faces. A closer look reveals that it has nothing to do with the face being covered, but actually the wound. Bedclothes are highly flammable and will increase the persistence and intensity of fire in that specific area, if one should be lit, severely diminishing the evidence of the real cause of death without drawing suspicion of arson by way of an accelerant. Which brings us to the mirrors. If you're going to light a fire and the windows aren't covered, the resulting light will make you visible to anyone who might happen to witness the event. Even if you stand out of sight of a window, either you, the bloody bodies, or both could still be reflected in one of the mirrors. So what we find is we have one kerosene lamp at the foot of the Stillinger girl's bed, with the chimney off, leaving the area where the flame would be entirely exposed. Upstairs, in Josiah and Sarah's bedroom, we find the same thing, a lamp at the foot of the bed with the chimney exposed. The result is one of these lamps on each floor of the house with the potential to light the entire place on fire, with the concentration of the flames being at the point of the murders. I know, that doesn't explain the bacon. But here's the thing about that. People have speculated to the extent that it's been said the 2-pound slab of bacon wrapped in a dish towel was actually intended as a makeshift vagina as part of the sexual assault against Lena Stillinger. It just simply does not fit the profile of this crime. Yes, much stranger things have happened, but it's really a stretch here. In my estimation, I look at the parallels between the bacon being wrapped in flammable cloth and the bodies, especially the faces where the wounds were incurred, being surrounded by the same in the form of the beds and the bedclothes. That's where the lanterns are found. It's where I believe they were intended to be used. But why bacon? It's likely that the people who committed these acts have never burned humans before. And while you could always get spotted leaving the scene of an arson like this, what's more likely to happen in the middle of the night is somebody eventually smells the bodies and other material within the home cooking, and it wakes them. Again, criminals look to delay reactions of this sort that bring attention to the scene too soon. So I believe the idea with the bacon being on the floor by the lamp and wrapped in a dish towel is that it would be one of the first things to burn. Bacon cooking is a distinct and highly desirable smell to many people, and one of the few burning smells that doesn't cause suspicion within the minds of people who were still sleeping. For instance, if neighbor Mary Peckham smells bacon cooking while asleep at 3:30 a.m., she's far less likely to jump up and call attention to the situation. But if she smells burning bodies, it might be unfamiliar and terrifying, causing her to take action. The second slab of bacon found in the icebox was intended to do nothing more than prove there was bacon inside the home, and that its cooking is likely what led to the fire. But as you can probably see, it just doesn't quite work. It's not going to look like an accident. And they know this, but only concede the truth once they've basically committed the perfect murder. They now stand to risk more by actually setting a fire before leaving the home. So they abandon the arson plot. And now they realize they need to cover the windows because they won't be burning the bodies in the house to conceal what's happened. The plate of food on the table in the kitchen was nothing more than something to aid the notion that someone had actually been cooking bacon and started a fire. Remnants of the plate likely would have remained. But the important thing to note here, and why I believe so strongly this is what happened, is that by not setting the fire, they bought hours of time before the scene was discovered. In terms of getting away with the crime, it was the wisest move, very much proven by the fact it hasn't been solved in over 100 years. So what you end up with is something that was initially intended to result in arson to conceal the crime, but they decided to reduce the risk in the aftermath because the murders went off without a hitch. For 1912, this is as clean as it gets, because leaving the scene of this murder and arriving home without being noticed is easier when authorities aren't responding to a fire and waking people. Arson, even today, but especially in 1912 when so many structures were almost exclusively made of wood, draws a lot of suspicion toward the motive of money. What was deemed a necessity prior to the execution of this plot was ultimately rendered pointless, if not damaging to their intended plight to conceal the crime. Or am I entirely wrong? Because a detective Wilkerson goes on to state that a man named William Mansfield, from Blue Island, Illinois, is the prime suspect in several other murders where similar tactics were used, including lamps at the foot of the bed, covered mirrors, and a basin with bloody water in it in the kitchen. Wilkerson speculates that Mansfield was hired by Frank F. Jones, a U.S. senator and former employer of Joe Moore, to kill the family in order to retain business interests, including a John Deere dealership, that he lost when Joe branched out on his own to form a competing implement company. In addition, Josiah reportedly had an affair with Frank's daughter-in-law. While it was a very seductive conclusion he drew, payroll records apparently prove William Mansfield was not, in fact, in the area at the time and could not have committed the murders, despite the fact that he very likely was a serial killer. Mansfield ultimately won a lawsuit against Wilkerson regarding the claims. Next up is Henry Moore, a man suspected of committing perhaps dozens of axe murders throughout the U.S., many with striking coincidences to the Villisca crime. However, as with the previous suspects, there's no definitive evidence apparent. Andy Sawyer is another. He was a hobo and transient worker who claimed to have been in Villisca on the night of the murders and seemed to be experiencing some type of mental illness, but couldn't even prove he was actually in Villisca when a sheriff from a neighboring town claims he put the man on a train at 11 p.m. that evening. The next suspect is Reverend George Kelly, a traveling preacher who was invited to the day ceremony on the night of the murders and also left town at 5 a.m. the next morning. Kelly ultimately confessed to the murders under what is commonly believed to be aggressive law enforcement practices, perhaps including torture, and the words are believed to be complete falsehood. His first trial ended in a hung jury, and the second was an acquittal. And that was that. The killer was never brought to justice. I could examine every detail of the aforementioned suspects from now until the end of time, but there's no clear answer to be found within that endeavor. So to venture a guess, my money is on Frank Jones being the mastermind of the crime. Who actually committed the murders? It's anybody's guess. But in the aftermath of the crime, only one person gained anything by the result. And that says quite a bit when that person is someone from whom you took a significant amount of business. More specifically, and in an evolutionary context, we need only follow the resources. And the transfer of resources upon Josiah Moore's death resulted in Frank Jones becoming a wealthier, more powerful man. As an Iowa state senator, it also stands to reason he had the easiest path to thwarting attempts at blaming him. So, while I believe the case will remain forever unsolved, this is clearly my choice. But in closing, I want to offer some thoughts on why this is such a popular case, why it's claimed its place among the other twisted terrors of American folklore. And I think it's because the nature of what happened focuses on the fragility of our existence, specifically how we operate at all times on little more than faith. The formation of the Moore family took decades, from the births of Josiah and Sarah to the raising of their children. In between was everything from the mundane realities of everyday life to the excitement of birthdays and holidays. But through it all, in order to have these things, or even to maintain anything in this world, they had to have faith. Because whatever it is, we all know that one day we'll lose it, and it will never come back. That's the irreconcilable nature of being human, an inescapable sense of doom that lingers like a dark storm cloud, even within the happiest of moments. You can lose everything in a flash. It's over. Nothing can change it for eternity. That's a sadness so profound, we have nowhere to turn but each other's arms. And so we do, tortured with the knowledge that even that privilege crumbles to dust in time. When the Moore family left for church that fateful evening, they did so together and gathered in a name of faith. Then they went home to the comfort of their beds and drifted into the world of dreams, never to see each other again on this earth. They were all taken away so suddenly and without any warning at all. And while this occurred in the context of a senseless massacre, it's difficult for me to not admit that sometimes I look around at all of the loss in my life and feel the same. It's all being taken away from me, day by day, and nothing's ever the same again once something or someone leaves. So the nightmare the Moore family endured is nothing more than a microcosm of what you and I are experiencing every day. It's the moment you look in the mirror and realize you're balding. It's the day your house sells in favor of an apartment because you've aged out of your high-paying corporate job. It's the wrinkles on your forehead, your car breaking down, your boyfriend saying he's found somebody else. It's all these things, all these tiny, horrible deaths that we die each and every day, with nothing to comfort or protect us, except faith. The Moores had that, in abundance. They believed, they lived it, and they drowned in the ignorance of hope anyway, just like the rest of us will. So the light at the end of the tunnel in this case is not the answer to who swung the axe, but the solution for how we end this suffering, how we eradicate the irreconcilable nature of human existence in favor of creating better lives. But the inherent problem within this is that, like all change, we need to die and be reborn in order for it to happen. This is what you and I are learning here right now. How to have faith in the pursuit of letting go of humanity in favor of something better. Eternal death should not be the result of some asshole rolling into your home in the middle of the night with an axe. We should be able to fix the problem. And we will. We just have to have faith. Keep moving the world forward. And most importantly, remember to love each other every day, no matter what. Just like the Moore family. That's the lesson. Because we all know the sun will rise again tomorrow. Here's hoping we see it.